Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Maddie, there are no victims in this classroom or on this podcast. This week, Film Spotting is out to inspire you, the listener, with our top five screen teachers, a tie-in with our review of Hamlet 2.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, a conversation with the star of Hamlet 2, Steve Coogan, and music this week, Adam, by Connor Oberst.
But first, rock me, rock me. Rock me, sexy Jesus.
When Dana Marshes didn't make it as an actor...
I'm having a herpes outbreak. But you never know it.
He became passionate about teaching.
Theater has the power to transform the audience.
And discovered...
I kicked this trash can.
He wasn't very good at that either.
I've been praying for more racial understanding, but I still get anxious around ethnics.
Just because they're Latinos doesn't make them gangbangers, got it?
We're just coming together as a class.
Oh my God! Ow!
Is he acting?
No, he's not that good.
Mr. Marks, could I have a minute?
The school board decided to cancel drama.
We need to save drama.
Put on a play, make it the best you've ever done.
Adam, I'm going to air a little bit of Film Spotting's dirty laundry. Demographic show that people respond to this really well.
Sure.
I think, and actually a lot of people out there would be surprised to learn that nestled between Raging Bull and All the President's Men on Adam's top five movies of all time is a little cinematic gem from 1989, Lean on Me. Morgan Freeman stars as Joe Clark, the tough love dispensing, bat wielding principal who isn't about to let trivial little matters such as civil liberties stand in the way of his delivering his kids a first rate education. And I think people also would be curious to know that Lean on Me is the one film Adam cannot tolerate being criticized in his presence. I remember we were in the food court at the Toronto International Film Festival. We were at the OJ, waiting out an ice cold Julius. When I started goofing around, as I'm wont to do, and I started making fun of Lean on Me's climactic scene. Spoiler alert, it involves the song of the same name. And I felt this burning on my arm, and I looked down, and I found myself in Adam's death grip. And he whispered to me, in all seriousness, knock it off. Knock it off. And I'm like, Adam, I'm just goofing around. He's like, seriously, dude, I'm seriously, just stop it right now. Not that movie. Not now. So I'm really, really curious, Adam, how you reacted to Hamlet 2, which takes direct aim at movies like your beloved Lean on Me and pulls absolutely no punches. I want to know, could you enjoy Hamlet 2? Or did you want to take Steve Coogan by the arm and say, seriously, knock it off?
Well, that was inspired stuff there, Maddie. Truly inspired. No, I didn't have that reaction, actually, even though the movie did parody great films like Lean on Me, the great Morgan Freeman, of course, in that film. I didn't actually know that was in my pantheon. I may have to look at that list again
and check it. Don't hide from it. This is a safe space. We're in the trust tree here.
But this movie definitely is taking aim at films like Lean on Me, Mr. Holland's Opus, other inspirational teacher movies like that, like Dangerous Minds. And I actually think that one of the big strengths of this movie, and you'll hear me talk about it here in the next segment with Steve Coogan a little bit, is that he wisely doesn't ever wink at the audience about the fact that he's playing a total loser. He plays this completely straight, and he makes you empathize with this pathetic character. I think that what Andrew Fleming, the director, and the co-writer, along with Pam Brady of South Park fame, does, I think what they do really well is that the only time they do wink at us a little bit as an audience is exactly when they should, when they're taking those jabs at those inspirational teacher movies. They don't just try to parody them or turn it into spoof. It says, yeah, we know we're stuck in an inspirational teacher movie. The question is, what happens if the teacher can't inspire? And I actually think that's really funny.
Well, actually, I'm going to disagree with you here. I think they're winking at us throughout the entire film, and I think that's why it works. Now, a little history lesson from Uncle Matty. In ancient Greece, during the Dionysia, the Festival of Plays, a playwright would put forth a cycle of tragedies consisting of three plays.
You lost me at ancient Greece,
yeah,
but okay.
Before Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty heady stuff. So to break the mood, what the Greeks would do between the second and the third play of a cycle, they would perform a satyr play. And this play featured satyrs, these little goat men, wearing phalluses and performing all kinds of ribald mischief. And often they would be spoofing not only, you know, familiar material that everybody would know, but sometimes the very material that you're watching. So imagine you're watching, say, the Oresteia, and you're just in between where the Furies have just hunted down Orestes, and you're about to find out if Athena is going to let him off the hook for killing his mother, who killed his father, who killed his daughter. And instead, right in the middle of the action, you get these little goat guys coming out and doing absolutely unspeakable things. So now imagine a trilogy of, say, Lean on Me, Hoosiers, and Dead Poets Society. I think Hamlet 2 is that satyr play,
yeah,
for those films. And this movie is not intended to tug at your heartstrings at all. It's just jokes. It,
yeah,
is joke after joke after joke. And luckily, they're very, very funny. I mean, there is no reason for Jesus to be in this film.
No.
Except for the fact that it is absolutely hilarious when he comes on to,
yeah,
perform Rock Me Sexy Jesus in this inexplicable production. And that's the difference. I actually don't think it's played straight at all, because if this really were one of those films, we would see him creating this work of fiction. We would see him putting his blood and sweat into this masterpiece to save the school. We don't get any of that.
Well, we do get a great montage where he's writing Hamlet too. He's
right,
writing his great creation.
But we don't really see what he's writing.
No.
We kind of hear it alluded to. It.
Yeah.
You know, there's Snoopy is involved somehow, and we never. So what actually he puts up there has nothing to do with the meat of the film.
No.
That it's just funny. It's just funny.
Yeah, it is. And actually, I don't think we disagree at all. Maybe we're getting sidetracked by semantics here. I think that Steve Coogan plays it straight,
yes,
though, within the comedy. Absolutely. They're winking
you're
at us the whole time.
You're absolutely right.
They're winking the whole time at us. They know they're making this inspirational teacher movie, but they're not just mocking it. They've literally put a character, put a teacher in it who thinks he's living an inspirational teacher movie. And that winking at us is really funny. And they do that really well. But I just think that Coogan is very smart about the way he plays his character.
Yes.
Where he's not trying to necessarily tug at our heartstrings, but when there's an emotional scene, when he actually has to break down a little bit, he doesn't play it just for mockery or to be pathetic. He actually goes for it. He's earnest about this character.
Right, and you contrast that performance, his performance, against all the supporting characters who are just caricatures. And they're caricatures for a reason.
Yes.
They are there to be these, you know, parodies of these stereotypes that we've seen time and time
and
again.
And they're effective at that,
and they
I
are
think.
Effective at that. I mean, they don't have fleshed out backstories, but that's okay. You're just supposed to laugh that the lead actress is a racist, that, you know, the effeminate male lead is, you know, is offended at
hiding
playing a gay guy.
Homosexual
exactly.
issues.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this thing is just completely politically incorrect, and luckily it's funny enough to sustain itself.
Yeah, it is. And I do think that Andrew Fleming is very good at walking a fine line, though, where he can be broad and really ridiculous, and yet I don't feel like he's ever really stooping for laughs. I just recently saw Dick, a movie I'd mm-hmm. always meant to catch up with, Kirsten Dunst and that, and Michelle Williams. And I think it's a very funny movie. And like this movie, it's patently absurd. You've got Will Ferrell and Bruce McCullough playing Woodward and Bernstein. That's how silly this movie is. And you've got the kids in the hall playing Nixon's henchmen. And yet you somehow actually buy into, at least for the comedy, you buy into this premise of these girls ingratiating themselves into the White House and breaking the Watergate case. And I just think that Fleming gets that. If you look at it from a certain perspective, of course, the Nixon presidency is a great tragedy and awful, but from another perspective, it's pretty damn hilarious. You don't actually have to up the comedy ante too much. You just have to play up the absurdity a little bit. And he gets that just right, and I think he does it here. Dana Marsh, he should be a total joke. He should be that caricature of every failed actor who you just find totally pathetic. But I think that this is a case where, in addition to Coogan, that Fleming and Pam Brady don't really allow it. They actually allow us to see him as kind of a flesh-and-blood character and empathize with him. I actually think it's one of the best performances of the year, at least comedically, that I've seen from Steve Coogan. He walks a fine line here really well.
Yeah, he really does elicit this empathy from the audience. And I think the bellwether for that is that one scene where he's rollerblading to work.
That's it.
Because he had a DUI or whatever. He can't drive, right?
Right.
Or probably can't, doesn't even own a car. And he's rollerblading to work, and he falls down in the middle of an intersection.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking.
It
really is heartbreaking. You feel for the guy, and it's really, really funny. He's also going to subsequently ram himself into a truck, and I laughed both times.
Right.
But again, those are the few moments of actual pathos, of actual heart.
Sure.
I was laughing more at Amy Poehler waltzing in and announcing that she, what's her name?
Cricket Feldstein.
Cricket Feldstein.
ACLU.
If you're wondering about the Feldstein, I married a Jew.
Yeah.
I was laughing at the more really absurd
sort
of in your face stuff. And I think this actually offers some of the best lines that we've heard all summer.
Yeah, it does. But I do think, for me, the funniest moment was that visual little bit where he's trying to skate on his rollerblades. You said it. But it's not just that he rams into something. At first, he just gets trapped in this sort of no man's
and
land.
And he can't get
up. He's in the middle of the road, and he can't
gain any momentum. We've all
And if you've
there.
Ever been on any kind of roller skate or rollerblade or whatever, you have been there. And that says everything about this character's life in that one shot. It's really brilliant. And there's also a great bit with the nasty critic, the journalist who writes for the school
Another
newspaper.
Another great bit. Very good
tears
bit.
Tears apart his plays year after year, putting on these productions of Aaron Brockovich. Very Rushmore-like there, a little too Rushmore-like to really be funny. But then you've got this nasty critic who's like a 14-year-old freshman just tearing Steve Coogan's Dana character apart. And it's just great because he hates him, and yet at the same time he's so starved for reassurance and approval as this quote-unquote artist that he actually goes to this nasty critic to get advice.
Yeah, exactly. You have to respect the critic. You have to respect the critic. That's the moral of the story.
Maybe
I think.
So.
That's what I walked out of there with.
I'm sure.
But also I want to mention Catherine Keener's performance. She's great. She's very, very dry. Unfortunately, David Arquette comes on, and his only role is to be ineffectual
dumb.
And boring. And he can't even pull that off.
No, he really can't. He's just there to be an object of Catherine Keener's ridicule. But I do want to note that the end production is truly hilarious. And there are some faults with this film. And one of them, I would say, is none of the stuff with the principal character works at all. None of those scenes are funny. And you've got this, Tucson, it's this kind of backwards town, the way it's portrayed, and it's not meant to rip on Tucson so much as, just represent all kind of backward towns or whatever. And they want to put up this fight, they're Philistines against this play that he wants to put on Hamlet to. None of that stuff really works at all, unfortunately. But then when you actually get to the play, I have to say, I think the end production is truly hilarious. It's awful, but at the same time, the singing and the dancing is actually fun to watch. And I actually believe the crowd getting into it a little bit. I think we should hear, before we go, Maddie, just a little bit of Rock Me Sexy Jesus.
Horrified and fascinated.
Rock me sexy Jesus. It's very, very South Park. A lot of fun.
Yeah, you definitely see Pam Brady's touch there, I think, in the musicals. But I read a little bit about Brady and Fleming just real quick. I want to add, they actually had no real experience at all putting together musical theater like this. I think they pulled it off really well. Those were really fun to watch. And the two caricatures, as you mentioned, the earnest acting students, Skylar Astin and Phoebe Strull, even though they are playing these caricature type roles, I think they're really funny. They stand in perfectly for those overeager drama students.
They are very, very overeager. I just didn't like her racism. I thought it could have been more overt. I think she could have taken it to another level. I think she
You wanted her to be more offensive?
I think she could have. It could have been more offensive. It just seemed like a little too much tacked on, not really standing for itself, really slapping me in the face. I want to be slapped in the face here.
I thought most of those bits were pretty funny, but we did like Hamlet too. If you see it, it's out now in limited release and will expand wide on August 29th. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail at 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater and a conversation with the star of Hamlet 2, Steve Coogan. Stay with us.
All the peacock people left the plumes in a pile. They look good to fall. And the Gulf water's warm like a bathtub full of lavender and Epsom salt. See a bleach blonde boy put his longboard down, help his girl get her sunscreen on.
I thought about you in your little house. Think you're lonely, but I could be wrong. And I wanna be your bootlegger. Wanna mix you up with something strange. Braid your hair like a sister. Name you like a hurricane. Right there, that's the postman sleeping in the sand. He's got a letter to deliver, but I can't stay mad. Oh, right there, that's the postman asleep in the sand. He's got a get well card to deliver. He's gonna do it by hand. He's gonna do it by hand.
I confront it. I acknowledge. I will tell you right straight from the most sincere depths of my heart, the film will not be good.
I don't feel like going to school. You finish your term paper, and maybe you get a B instead of an A plus that you wanted, so you get a B.
But I'm going to get an F.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. I'm Maddie. That's Adam. It's time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I absolutely massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard between Eleanor Coppola and Francis Ford Coppola from Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, not to be confused with Apocalypse Now.
Right.
A tie-in, of course, with our review last week of Tropic Thunder.
How do you like us now, listeners? We got an eighth of the entries we got for Office Space, and Hearts of Darkness is a fantastic movie. Obviously, a lot more people need to check it out. All I can say is, for shame, for shame.
Oh, it's a great film from the 90s. And of course, I've said this before, an example of when a documentary about the film is actually better than the bloated film
itself.
I don't
know about that. You can disregard what
Maddie
just said.
Why don't you reach into that meager-looking film spotting hat and pull out this week's winner?
And the winner is Mike Johnson in Los Angeles, California. Oh, Maddie, where's that at?
I know right where it is, but Mike, I know, is a longtime listener.
Congratulations, Mike. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
My agent's attempting to urge me towards Royal Shakespeare Company again.
Oh, splendid.
He's just had an audition for Rep.
Oh, splendid. So you're a thespian, too.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and we'll go ahead and tell you that it does tie in with our theme, Top 5 Screen Teachers. And Maddie, I started off, you're going to give me the direction.
And action.
What did you want to be when you were young?
When I was a kid, I wanted to be John Lennon.
Blank. Don't be a goof. I'm trying to make a serious point here. I've been teaching for 22 years, and each year, these kids get more and more arrogant.
Oh, BS, man. Come on, Blank. The kids haven't changed. You have. You took a teaching position because you thought it'd be fun, right? Thought you could have your summer vacations off, and then you found out it was actually work, and that really bummed you out.
These kids turned on me. They think I'm a big effing joke.
Come on. Listen, if you were 16, what would you think of you, huh?
And scene. I actually don't want to know the answer to that question. If you know what film we just massacred, send us an email along with your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback at filmspotting.net by Wednesday, August 27th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. I am guessing we're going to have more entries this
probably
week. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
It's done.
What is?
My original work that's going to save drama, the thing I've been working on for the last 47 billion hours.
Oh, is that what you were doing? I thought you were just having a nervous meltdown.
You're not far off, Lady Pence. Any creative person will tell you, you got to go a little crazy to make great art.
Hamlet 2?
The Deuce, correct.
Another clip there from the movie Hamlet 2, starring Steve Coogan, who I just recently had a chance to sit down with here in Chicago. Was a real pleasure for me. I am a big fan of his. Do you have a favorite Steve Coogan performance?
I think it would have to be Tony Wilson in 24 Hour Party People. I love him in that film. You know, here in America, I think we're just starting to get our exposure to him. I know he's been big in England for a long time, on television there, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right there. But hopefully more people will get a chance to see him now. He really is a fantastic comedic actor. I really like him as well in Tristram Shandy. And when I talked to him here a few weeks ago, I started by asking him who I should blame for the fact that I cannot get that song, Rock Me Sexy Jesus, out of my head.
Oh, you can blame Pam Brady
of Team America and South Park fame, and Andy Fleming, the writer-director. Yeah, I mean, when you know that they've got those credits, you know there's going to be something that's slightly offensive in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this was the breakout hit at Sundance. Unfortunately, it screened right after I left Sundance, and you've been doing publicity for it now. You were here in Chicago, here obviously for a screening and a Q&A. How has the audience reaction been to the movie?
Just way better than I ever expected. I mean, I knew it was an odd movie, which is kind of what attracted me to it. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a slightly strange subject matter, but I didn't think it would be as broad and as popular and as crowd pleasing mm-hmm. as it is. I thought it would be kind of just a kind of one of those movies for kind of cool people, you
right?
Know? But it's I was in the cinema last night, and I was in the one in Sundance, and I was in another one the other night, and people seem to really warm to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm always curious, are there parts of the movie that you're seeing the crowd consistently react to, no matter what city you're in, parts that maybe you didn't think were that hilarious that are really getting laughs, or vice versa?
There's always those moments where you think the audience... It's always surprising when the audience... I'm trying to think of a specific example, but there's I think Amy Poehler... That does a couple of tiny ad libs that gets like huge reactions.
Yeah,
and I think I do. I like to think I did a couple of ad libs that get huge reactions as well.
Yes, I'm sure.
But it's really gratifying when an audience picks up on the little things. You know that they're really paying attention. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's been happening a lot. You know, there's the big laughs that you expect people to laugh at. But when they pick up on the little detail mm-hmm. and they get that as well, then you know they're really paying attention.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the odd nature of the film being something that attracted you to it. What did get you attached to this project?
I read a lot of what I call kind of cookie-cutter comedy scripts that are kind of pretty formulaic, and they're either kind of college movies or mm-hmm. whatever's popular at the time. There's always a bunch of copycat movie scripts out there. This one just... It didn't feel like it had been written to a remit. It mm-hmm. felt like the two guys that had written it, who I hadn't met at this stage, were writing something that they wanted to do and that made them laugh. And so it had that kind of authenticity about it.
It
didn't feel like some cynical hack just churning it out. It really, really kind of came off the page for me. And just I think the first thing that I liked about it was I think on page two of the script it has my character Dana Marsh, the high school teacher, putting on a school stage production of Erin Brockovich.
Uh-huh.
And that straight away, I read that made me laugh, and I couldn't, and I was like, I would never have thought of something like that as being funny, and
right.
It just made me laugh so much, and I kind of at that moment I thought I think I know who this guy is.
Mm-hmm.
Straight away I was like, I know this guy. He's I knew that it was an earnest guy, who's slightly off target. You know.
Yeah. Well, and actually there's a great line in the movie where one of the characters says that enthusiasm is more important than talent. That's definitely the case with him, isn't it? That's what gets him through. Do you think that's true in life?
I think someone said it's a very dangerous message to put out there, because you'll get lots and lots of people sort of churning out unmitigated rubbish.
Right.
Because they're doing it because they're enthusiastic. But you don't have to produce a masterpiece. You know, if someone wants to carve a piece of driftwood and put it on the mantelpiece and it makes them happy and nobody else, then why not? Why shouldn't they do that?
Yeah. You know? Well, I want to get this quote right here, because the director, Andrew Fleming, he said that one actor he talked with for the part of Dana was worried that he was going to look like an ass. But Steve loves to look like an ass. So I want to know, do you love to look like an ass, or do you just accept that you're really good at it and it's really funny?
I always do parts where I don't mind how dumb I look. I play for high stakes, you know. I think I'll look as dumb as I have to look if I think it's going to get the laughs.
Mm-hmm.
If it's going to get the laughs and people are going to, then I'll play for high stakes. You might as well sort of do everything. I mean, I even sort of drop my pants.
Yes.
In a creative way, which is relevant to the script, of course, to get a laugh. I think it's something to do with... You know, a lot. Sometimes you see actors in movies, and it's clear they want to look and appear cool
mm-hmm.
throughout the whole movie. And I just can't do that. And I've become self conscious doing that. I'm much more at ease when I'm making an ass of myself, because then I can just. It's like, you know, when you go to a nightclub and you think I'm gonna try and dance,
uh-huh.
and you think, if I try and dance seriously, I'm gonna look like an ass. So I might as well dance like an idiot and get a laugh.
There you go.
You know.
Yeah. We're here on Film Spotting talking with Steve Coogan, the star of the new movie Hamlet 2. And with movies like 24-Hour Party People and Tristram Shandy, you're definitely winking at the audience. And even more than that, you're blatantly making yourselves aware of the fact that they're there. You're addressing the audience. I'm curious about this part of Dana. I think it would have been very easy for you to sort of wink at the audience a little bit and let them in on the fact that, hey, I know I'm playing a loser. But you don't ever do that. No. You have genuine affection that comes through and then translates to us.
I'm glad you spotted that, because that was what's really important about this film, I think, that makes it work, is that it's smart, but it's not cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy, if anything, the thing that Andy did as a director, he made sure that when I was playing the part, although there's a lot of funny moments and things where you're kind of laughing at the character I play, what can be the death knell of a comedy is if you feel that the guy, that the actor, in this case me, is laughing or judging the character I'm playing. If you think, like you say, I'm thinking the guy I'm playing is an ass, and I know he's an ass, then you kind of start to lose respect for the character. Andy always made sure that during the kind of emotional parts of the movie that I committed,
yeah,
and that he'd even say to me, you don't need to try and be funny at this moment. Just be sad. Don't forget about trying to make the audience laugh. Just be sad. There's plenty of funny stuff around it. Let this moment be a sad moment, because the audience, I've got to really, they have to give a damn about what's happening to, mm-hmm, the character to stay with the movie for 90 minutes. I think if you're just doing funny gags, the audience will stay with you for maybe a half hour.
Yeah.
And then after that, they want some real meat, you know.
This is so true.
Yeah.
Seen plenty of movies like that this summer. And it's a testament, really, to Andrew Fleming and Pam Brady as writers and as a director, and you as an actor in particular. There's a monologue scene you have that you totally commit to and is genuinely emotional, and never once did I hear anybody in the audience snickering or looking for a laugh there. It works completely just as an emotional scene. I also noticed the scenes with Catherine Keener as your wife. I thought those were great because those were genuinely emotional scenes. How did you guys approach those with Catherine, with Andrew?
Well, Catherine Keener is one of those people who as a fan kind of thing, you know, you look at a movie, sometimes you're scrolling through movies or you want to see what to watch. If she's attached to a movie, you think, well, you trust her judgment. You think it's going to be an interesting movie. At the very least, it's going to be an interesting movie. She's fun to be around, but she takes the role very seriously and is very truthful about it. And she again prevented me from falling into what is a potential trap that even I'm not immune to, which is just trying to do the technical funny stuff, because she gave it emotional truth, and that made me raise my game, and it made me sort of pull my socks up and make sure that I wasn't doing, if you like, sort of a demonstrative performance,
mm-hmm,
where you're just checking the boxes,
right?
And you're not emotionally committing. And she really went for it, and so there was proper kind of tension in that, and it just elevates it beyond being beyond the dumb comedy. And there is dumb comedy in there for people who want it, right?
Right.
In spades. But she talked things through. She wouldn't just accept. She wanted to know why something was happening or why I was doing something. And why she, you know, what bothered me was why this woman would be with a guy like me in the movie, because I have a lot of sort of those kind of foolish qualities that make a comic character laughable. It was one of the things that helped me with the character was the fact that she said, you know, she loved this guy because, initially, when she was in a relationship with him, because he has a kind of purity about him, an, mm-hmm, innocence, and a kind of, in some ways, a naivety, but a real genuine passion. And he, as a character, is very uncynical,
mm-hmm,
and that's kind of we live in a very cynical world. So when you see that, it's kind of you naturally want to protect him. I think that there's a scene where I'm with a head teacher who's kind of is threatening to close down the drama department, mm-hmm, and that to me is where you start rooting for it, because however much of a fool I am in the movie, when you see someone, you know, being bullied, you kind of root for the guy who's trying to do the right thing.
Sure. Well, there are so many laugh out loud moments in the film, and I think a couple in particular with Catherine Keener, who I've never particularly thought of as a funny actress before, and so it was great to see that here. But the moment, for example, where you're playing the song when you're visiting the sperm doctor and you're in the waiting room, or, mm-hmm, where she's got the, you know, 44-gallon margarita at the Mexican restaurant, those are really funny scenes, and I did come out of it just for a second, start thinking to myself, what was this set like? I mean, were you guys cracking each other up with some of this stuff?
Yeah, we were. It's you know, you've got to concentrate on the truth of it. But yeah, we were laughing constantly. She's a very funny person to be around. She's got a sort of slight unpredictability when she does a performance. She doesn't like do the same thing twice, so it really makes you very alert. And so things are very fresh, so it's, anything can happen at any time. And there's always a little, like I say, that unpredictability means that quite how a scene's going to turn out is not set. So it stops it being stagnant, you know. It's not like, okay, we're going to do this from this angle, then we're going to turn the camera over and put it over there, we do the same thing every time, blah, 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 blah. It wasn't like that.
And how much leeway did the director, Andrew Fleming, give you to improvise?
Maybe 10% of the movies improvised. Ideas are tried out. It's not like do what you like. It's kind of, I'll say, can we try this or can we try that? Or what about if I do this? And, there's a scene where I'm trying to write and a cat is staring at me.
Yeah.
And I make out, because I'm slightly losing my mind, that the cat's somehow trying to freak me out
right.
by staring into my soul. And it's just a cat looking at me, you know. and so that kind of thing's, and we tried that, you know, that was something we just tried out.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if this will be funny.
Right.
And it's good to have those things and have that kind of flexibility when you're on set, because you can't always tell until you're shooting quite what's going to work. There's a scene where I said, would it be funny or interesting and funny if I started crying looking at the color of a folder because the color was a sad color,
uh-huh.
which is kind of weird and surreal. Yeah. That's the kind of stuff we try on set. So there'd be a little bit of leeway. But
sure.
In actual fact, most of it was pretty much what was on the page. I'd say sort of 90%. And I think oftentimes a script or a movie can look improvised when the dialogue just flows very freely
mm-hmm.
and it's very well written. It's
sure.
kind of it's the curse of good art is that the more difficult and well crafted it is, the easier it kind of looks.
Sure. You know? Yeah. Well, this isn't a parody of inspirational teacher movies, but you do acknowledge some of these films, like Dangerous Minds, like Mr. Holland's Opus. Did you watch any of these movies for inspiration before film?
I'd seen Mr. Holland's Opus a long time ago, and was the Dead Poets Society. Was that referenced? That's referenced as well. Yeah. And I've not seen Dangerous Minds. I've seen bits of it. The fact that his tastes are kind of like quite broad tastes. His tastes are those movies that are kind of very popular but have a modicum of worthiness about them, or there's a kind of self-importance to them. And they're often good movies, but there's a sort of there's a slight kind of tabloid streak.
Yeah.
Of depth to them that's kind of weird to kind of quantify, but it's almost like bad writing. He tells the kids, he says, I'm an inspirational teacher. I'm going to inspire you, you know, that's what I do. I inspire people.
Uh-huh.
Like that's his job. Of course the comic irony and construct conceit is that ultimately he does end up doing that, so we have our cake and eat it.
Right, you know? Exactly. In your days as a drama student, did you have teachers like Dana?
Yes is the simple answer. Interesting about, you know, being raised, having been through a kind of classical drama training, is that it attracts people who are very emotionally, you have to be kind of slightly emotionally open to want to act anyway.
Yeah.
So it has people who wear their hearts on their sleeve and are very, very effusive and demonstrative about their emotions, who you wouldn't find working in an office or a bank.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'd be fired for being unstable, but it does attract people like that. So they're kind of larger than life figures and great fun to play, because normally you play characters that it's all about being small and economical and naturalistic. And here's a guy who was real but just big in everything he does. And
yeah.
That's always a gift.
You shot this movie in Albuquerque. It actually takes place in Tucson. I don't think it's a movie that the tourism board of Tucson is going to be prominently displaying anytime soon. Have you actually screened the movie in Tucson? Do you know what the reaction is?
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure. I have visited Tucson myself, but we shot it in Albuquerque, New Mexico. But I think, you know, I mean, when Andy chose Tucson, it could have been. The whole point of choosing Tucson was not specifically that it was Tucson, but it had to be somewhere that was not what you would call a bastion of liberalism.
Right.
So it had to have that kind of slight conservative element to it. and be somewhere that is not somewhere that you imagine would embrace the arts. So you know, it couldn't be East Coast or West Coast. It had to be somewhere that was just far away from Bohemia, and Tucson kind of checked that box.
I have to ask you about a couple of upcoming projects or current projects. First of all, my six-year-old son, whenever he's asked what his favorite movie is, try as I might to get him to say The Godfather, the fact is he says Night at the Museum. It's his favorite movie. He was very jealous when I told him I was coming to talk to Octavius today. So what can you tell me about Night at the Museum 2?
Well, I'm shooting it next month. I'm playing Octavius again. I'm going to be doing scenes with Owen Wilson. As I can't remember what his character's
called. Jedediah.
Jedediah, that's right, Jedediah.
My son reminded me of that this morning.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah.
It's funny, when I was shooting in Tucson, shooting in Albuquerque, the students at the school we were shooting were saying, "Who the hell are you? You know, who are you? What have you been in? Who are you?" They're kind of real upfront. You know, give me a resume. You know. And I said, "Well, I played the soldier in Night at the Museum." Oh, you're a
teenager. They knew that.
It's funny that you do something small like that, and it kind of bizarrely, it kind of. You know, it caught people's imagination within the movie. They kind of really warmed to those two characters that myself and Owen played. I have a fight with a giant squirrel. That's all I'm going to tell you.
Wonderful.
I've thrown you a bone there.
That is a tease. And basically, the students then treated you a lot like they treat Elizabeth Shue in the movie, asking, who are you?
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. Elizabeth Shue, who played herself, and that was one of the delights of the movie.
Those scenes are great. Michael Winterbottom, shooting another film with him that's coming out, and a big fan of his. He's been here on the show, actually, and I believe that is in production anyway. What can you tell us about the next Winterbottom project?
Well, the next Winterbottom project, it's still at the talking stage. Michael and I, obviously, we did two movies together, 24 Hour Party People and Tristram Shandy, and he's a fantastic filmmaker. He's someone I have a really close kind of collaborative relationship and friendship with, and there's kind of like two or three things that we're kind of talking about, and one of them's going to become a reality.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't know which of those three things is going to catch fire, but I'll be working with him next year on a movie, and it'll be something that has there'll be some of the DNA that's in 24 Hour Party People or Tristram Shandy. For any of those kind of underground kind of movie buffs who know what those movies are, they have their very strong sort of identity. But I'll definitely be doing something else with him. He's a fantastic filmmaker.
Well, I know many of our listeners are familiar with those movies. If you are listening and aren't familiar with Steve's work in 24 Hour Party People or Tristram Shandy, definitely check those out. And you can see Steve this summer in Hamlet 2 and in Tropic Thunder coming out. Can't wait to see that. It was really great to have you on. I'm a really big fan. Thank you.
Thank you.
I forget. You were wonderful in Leaving Las Vegas.
Oh, thank
you.
And
so fabulously funny in Adventures in Babysitting. Not forgetting Cocktail with Tom Cruise. What is he like? He seems totally great. What are you doing in Tucson? Oh, my God, I'm freaking out.
Again, that was my conversation with the star of Hamlet 2, Steve Coogan. And Maddie, off air, I did get him to divulge a few more details of some of those projects he's working on with Michael Winterbottom. I hope they come to fruition. Really funny stuff. I love that partnership. Great actor-director duo.
Sounds like a really down-to-earth guy, which is really nice when you come across that in this business.
He really was, and you can check out a picture or two from the interview that I did with Steve Coogan on our website, filmspotting.net.
All right, well, time for another quick break. When we come back, you know, it's amazing that you two can be absolutely correct about every point you made in your review of Pineapple Express and still be wrong. Your feedback is next. Stay with us.
Oh, 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 brother totem pole, I saw your legends lined up, and I never felt more natural. Apart, I just came apart. Please, 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 Sister Socrates, you always answer with a question, show some kindness to a petty thief. Migrant smoke in the old orange grove and the red rocket blaze over Cape Canaveral. You've been a father to me, your 1960s speak. Give me comatose joy like we run TV while the mountains are shining wild colors of my destiny.
Hey, Adam and Maddie, it's Chris calling from Provost, Alberta, Canada. I just got a chance to listen to your review of Le Cercle Rouge, directed by the great Jean-Pierre Melville. I just recently discovered him, and for me, It was Alain Delon, who's just absolutely unbelievable in that movie, as well as the movie Le Samurai. If you haven't seen that, you should check it out.
Gentlemen, hello. This is Tom Macy over in Brooklyn. Regarding Le Cercle Rouge, I am stoked that you guys liked it so much, and particularly Alain Delon. You guys were slurping him pretty heavily. I can't say I blame you. He is definitely one of my top man crushes. My roommate and I, after watching Le Samurai, which I think is even superior to Le Cercle Rouge, tried to show his girlfriend an interview of Alain Delon, and it's like, oh, look how awesome and hot and sexy this guy is. And she kind of looked at us, and he's like, all right, guys, I'm going to go do something else.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. Chris and Tom there chiming in our voicemails, both with some thoughts on Le Cercle Rouge, the fifth film in our classic heist movies marathon. We discussed it a few weeks ago here on the show, and they were as taken with the star of that movie, Alain Delon, as much as we were, and they really both made me want to see Le Samurai even more than I already did. But what was really interesting is Tom brought up this whole concept, Maddie, of man crushes, and I do think if we had to confess to man crushes, Alain Delon, along with Steve McQueen from The Getaway, right, would be very high up or near the top of those lists. But I could never get your predecessor to actually commit to doing a top five man crushes list, something about credibility, as if we ever had any.
Right.
My question to you is, will you give in to a man crushes top five?
Denzel, Danny Kaye, sure. Why not? Jack Lemmon, Jeff Bridges, let's go.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that future top five. And we have a poll question here tying in with our classic heist movies marathon. We asked you what's your favorite film from the heist movies marathon, obviously knowing that not everyone can play along at home, but we got a lot of great feedback on this marathon. I think it probably was our most participated in marathon ever. We want to know which one was your favorite. Here they are in the order we watched them: The Lavender Hill Mob, The Killing, Rafifi, The Italian Job, Le Cercle Rouge, The Getaway, or Check Back With Me Later. Maddie, did people really follow along or not?
No, people wonder why I drink. And this is, I don't even know why I do this anymore. Number one at 37%, Check Back With Me Later.
They'll catch up to him eventually, Maddie. We piqued their interest. That's enough, isn't it?
I'm despondent. Go on without me. Rafifi in at second at 27%. The Killing, 12%. Le Cercle Rouge, 10%. The Italian Job, 7%. The Getaway, 4%. And the Lavender Hill Mob coming in at 3%.
No love for Alec Guinness there coming in last, but we'll share our pick for Best Picture of the Marathon, plus all of our Best of the Heist Marathon Awards next week on the show. And we have been getting suggestions. We appreciate all of them. I don't think, though, Maddie, that either of us have seen that name that just really jumps out and says, yep, that's it. We got to call the awards that.
I'm leaning towards the Stefan Waz.
You want the Stefan Waz.
Yeah.
That one would be good, of course, tying in with Rafifi. So maybe it will be that. But if you do have an idea, send it to us, feedback at filmspotting.net.
Yeah, I like that because it also requires that you have played along so that you get the reference.
You get the reference, yeah. No, that's a good point there. This week's poll question, we're asking you about Shakespeare. Doesn't really tie in with movies per se. Ties in with our review, of course, of Hamlet 2 a little bit. And, of course, having a drama major and an English major sitting here behind the microphones, it makes sense that we're a little bit curious about your predilection for Shakespeare. So our question for you is, I prefer Shakespeare's
comedies, Midsummer Night's Dream, The Tempest, etc., histories / king plays, Henry V, Richard III, etc., tragedies like Hamlet or King Lear, or movie adaptation starring Mel Gibson or Leo DiCaprio.
I know you're going with the last one, right, Maddie?
Exactly. Exactly. No, I love, this is really hard. I love Henry IV Part 1. I mean, Prince Hal, my favorite character ever created.
Yeah, actually, I think I'm with you on that. I like him when he grows up, too, in Henry V, which is why I would go with histories in the King plays. Those ones always have been my favorite. I actually wanted to name my first child Hal, or at least give him a nickname Hal, maybe name him Henry. Sarah was not going for that, unfortunately. But we want to know what you think. Let us know about your preference for Shakespeare at filmspotting.net.
Ah, cross joint.
Yeah.
Never smoked one of those?
You can smoke this?
Oh, yeah, man.
No.
This is the future. This is like the apex of the vortex of joint engineering.
A clip there from the movie we discussed on last week's show, Pineapple Express, from director David Gordon Green and producer Judd Apatow. And Maddie, we definitely got some split opinions here, some split reactions to our review of the film, which was tepid, I think we can say at best. Why don't you start with Joel from Long Island, New York?
He writes in, hey, before I argue with you guys, I've enjoyed all the shows I've listened to and have agreed with much of what you guys have said about films I've seen. And then you reviewed Pineapple Express. I'm going to have to disagree with almost everything you guys said. And no, I did not see it under the influence of drugs. It just seems your reactions were a result of high expectations. Look, I can't blame you. I had high expectations as well. But I still thoroughly enjoy the film. I might go so far as to say it's the funniest Apatow film yet.
Crazy.
Yeah, he hasn't seen Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I found every action and fight scene to be hilariously over the top from the very beginning. Maybe the massive action finale goes on a bit too long, but it's not a departure from the rest of the film at all in terms of tone, and the very final scene makes up for that anyhow. About the only thing we agreed on outside of James Franco's performance, he truly was the star of the film. You know, most of your criticisms seem to be leveled at the lack of seriousness in the film, so I'm not even going to waste your time addressing them. I think the film is very much in the hot fuzz category of buddy action parody, as much as it's a quote-unquote stoner movie. And for you to look at the roles of Gary Cole and Rosie Perez and other small parts so critically is entirely missing the point. Maybe the film was just finely tuned to the sense of humor of me and my friends. Once again, we are not stoners, but we all found it to be consistently entertaining and hilarious.
I'm glad he had that reaction. I don't think this movie's anywhere on the level of Hot Fuzz.
Not at all.
For example, and it's interesting because he brings up Gary Cole and Rosie Perez and how we criticize their roles or lack thereof. About how much time of our discussion did we actually spend talking about Gary Cole and Rosie Perez?
Very, very little.
About 10 seconds, about because how much time they had in the
exactly,
film.
Exactly, exactly.
So I don't see how we were to bring that up. It was a small criticism.
Comedy is always going to be relevant. And, of course, we have to wonder when we're not laughing, what's going
why
on. And one of the reasons where I see a great comedic actor like Gary Cole completely wasted, then I need to point to it and say, hey, look, why are you doing this? I could be laughing right now. Have Gary Cole do something funny.
Exactly. And in terms of our criticisms being leveled at the lack of seriousness in the film, I actually don't know what Joel's talking about there. I certainly was not expecting anything serious about Pineapple Express. I just wanted to laugh. Didn't get enough of them, unfortunately. Even though there were, we said during our review, some great hilarious bits, especially with James Franco. Amy Raritan in Oakland, California, she's going to have a rebuttal to Joel here. A couple friends and I just saw it last night and we're all pretty frustrated, to say the least. I'm tired of Seth Rogen's face and Judd Apatow related projects at this point.
I think it's an ex-girlfriend writing in
maybe
here.
So, but I still couldn't resist the David Gordon Green angle, despite your guys' warning that he really doesn't do anything with the material. I would agree, considering the only scenes that could be recognized as Green's aesthetic style were when Dale and Saul were in the forest playing around, and secondly, when they were running all over the neighborhood to eventually arrive at Angie's parents' house. While I laughed out loud a few lines near the beginning, as the film progressed, I found less and less to laugh about. They may have been making fun of action comedies, but the action was really too gratuitous and the fight scenes dragged on to the point of boredom. I also found the racism regarding the Chinese rival drug lords and towards Rosie Perez's character unnecessary and unfunny. The same goes for the stupid gay stuff. The belt buckle scene, please. Maybe I do just hate comedies because plenty of other people were laughing in our theater, but I thought this film was dumb, dumb, dumb.
Well, I completely agree. And a lot of people actually pointed to the scene in the forest as an example of David Gordon Green's work. As saying, well, look, that's what he always does. That's what he did in George Washington. He just lets the camera go. You're supposed to just go with it. Well, look, if that exemplifies his style and it comes across as lazy and sloppiness, even if it's deliberate lazy and sloppiness, it's still lazy and sloppy. And I could not enjoy it at all. That scene tortured me more than any other. I just wanted them to do something. Or if you're not going to do something to move the plot forward, then do something funny. And unfortunately, that dynamic was just not strong enough to carry that part of the film for me.
No, and you're right. That scene was one a lot of defenders of this film pointed to. Sean from Cincinnati, Scott Tobias, our buddy from the AV Club, wrote in on our message boards, and what Sean said was, David Gordon Green's stamp was a little montage in the woods where he had some soft music playing while they smoked weed, blew it on a caterpillar, and proceeded to play leapfrog. I have to say, I don't remember, and again, I am not by any means a David Gordon Green expert, but having seen all of his films other than Undertow, I don't remember any musical montages like that where they're really comprised of edits in any David Gordon Green film. I may be way off here, but I don't remember them. I remember a lot of those moments in Judd Apatow films, mm-hmm. however. They're all over-knocked up. They're in every film of his I've seen, even The 40-Year-Old Virgin. And Matt Singer, our buddy from IFC News, wrote in defending Gordon Green too and said that he thought the action scenes had this very loose style that Gordon Green brought to it. The three-way fight between Rogan, McBride, and Franco looked like it was filmed completely spontaneously with no rehearsal or pre-planning.
I'll second that.
Both very funny.
I'll second that.
And very true to the way idiots like them would fight, I thought anyway. I agree with Matt. Actually, I think that scene's very funny. I did laugh at that scene quite a bit, but I would put that exact same scene up against what we saw from Adam McKay in Step Brothers when Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly go at each other in this extended fight. It's edited and shot in exactly the same way. I'm sorry. I think they're reaching a little bit to try and defend David Gordon Green. There's nothing magnificent about what he does with this material.
No, and what about that one musical montage where they're smoking the weed from the kids, or they're trying to sell the weed to the kids?
That's David Gordon Green, Maddie.
Yeah, oh, exactly. That pedestrian sort of cut to James Franco doing the snake.
Right.
Not funny.
Well, and I would just say it's an Apatow thing. You see that in his movies all the time. I don't see it so much in David Gordon Green, but nevertheless, we move on to Mike.
All right, Mike Spring writes in from Albany, New York. Rarely have you guys ever been so right and so wrong about a movie as you were about Pineapple Express. You were right that it was a big disappointment and that James Franco was terrific. However, it was a big disappointment because it's a truly terrible film. I agree with your comments about Seth Rogen, Maddie, but how can you say that the action scenes provided real stakes and consequences for the character? At what point was I supposed to believe that these characters could actually die? Which leads me to the other parts you got so wrong. Danny McBride? Really? You guys thought he was funny? Because I found him to be the most annoying, interminable character to grace the silver screen since, wait for it, Adam, Jar Jar Binks. Actually, I'd rather watch Jar Jar in a remake of The Godfather than sit through a single scene with this guy. And the diner scene at the end of the film is one of the worst scenes of the movie.
No.
It makes the endings in Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, seem short by comparison.
Well, I got two words for Mike Spring, who is the editor of DVD Snapshot, and that is thug life. I think that Danny McBride,
I thought he was a revelation,
is really funny in this movie. I'm sorry about that. Obviously, we saw the film on similar terms to some extent, but I really thought Danny McBride was great, and I love the end scene. So you're right. We're just going to have to agree to disagree on that.
But he does make the point about the consequences of the violence. Look,
yeah, I didn't know where you were going with that.
Well, very early on, they introduce Gary Cole shooting a guy,
sure,
and his head explodes all
That's
over
true.
A window. I was on board for that. I'm like, wow, someone actually could get clipped,
mm-hmm,
here. But as it goes on, no, it just becomes silly, silly, silly.
Yeah, it does. We'll close with this one from Bob M., also in Albany, New York. You know, it's amazing that you two can be absolutely correct about every point you made in your review of Pineapple Express and still be wrong. Yes, the direction is unimpressive and disappointing, especially because George Washington is one of my all-time favorite movies. Some of the actors could be given a little more to do, and there are some unrealistic fighting scenes, but that's all beside the point. A movie doesn't have to be perfect to be great, and that's exactly what Pineapple Express is. A great movie. First of all, James Franco and his character Saul alone are worth the price of admission. How can you not have a good time just spending the 80 minutes hanging around with Saul? Besides, being a college student, I of course have a friend like Saul. Okay, a bunch of friends like Saul. And most of my time spent with this Saul is sitting around watching Good Times. And I still have a good time. So having the treat of having this type of personality actually do something for once, count me in.
Well, the fact of the matter is, I would love to watch a movie with Saul and Bob M. Because I think Bob M. from Albany could interact with James Franco better than Seth Rogen.
Ouch.
You know, I really do. That was my big problem. Seth Rogen didn't know how to react to this comedic gold being brought to him by James Franco.
Marie.
Get away.
Marie. Stop, Marie. Get stop away. Right there. Stop right
there. Oh, what are you going to do? Kill me?
Marie.
Is that what's next?
Listen, stay calm. Stay calm. Whatever we do, we have to do it together. We have to be...
And we transition now to some of your top five on-the-run movies feedback. This was a tie-in with our review of Pineapple Express a few weeks ago, and we had to play a scene there from The Bourne Identity. Many listeners, like Pruthvi here, who couldn't believe we left off The Bourne Identity.
All right, writing in from Pune, India. After a lot of prodding from friends and from your good words, as I remember, about the Bourne trilogy, I finally sat down to watch it. I'd tried earlier when it's always turned off within the first few minutes of the first Bourne Identity. Now, three movies and a lot of running later, I feel sorry that I did not visit them earlier. To maintain the high quality of action chases with clarity about each character's location across three movies is a feat in and of itself. The movie has so many great chase sequences. It is ridiculous how each new one feels fresh, exhilarating, and fun. Look, I'm just guessing you forgot about this one, given so many other great movies on your top five, but it could have popped up in the honorable mentions as the best damn amnesia-trigger James Bond-esque globe-hopping chase thriller set of movies ever.
And John Heberly in Bay Village, Ohio agrees, I just finished the show and cannot believe you guys forgot the Bourne Identity. Jason Bourne running from the entire world's police force and a special group of assassins? How could you miss one of the greatest action films ever made? Certainly better than Terminator 2, which was on your list, Maddie.
Ooh.
I'm assuming you just forgot it, because if you intentionally left it off, well, we just can't be friends anymore.
Well, I love how the Bourne Identity has brought together India and Ohio in the same listener feedback. I love the Bourne movies. I remember there's a lot of running, but I also remember Bourne is running towards something throughout most of the film. He's not necessarily just running away. And again, I don't love the Bourne movies as much as you guys
Bite your tongue.
Well, look, I like them. I think they're very entertaining, but it is a lot of Matt Damon running.
It is, but I absolutely adore all of those films. And I just have to say to Pruthvi and John and everyone who wrote in, you're right. I just forgot them. I literally just somehow forgot about the Bourne trilogy.
What are you bumping off?
I would have bumped off whatever my number five was. It would have been my number one probably, actually. I have to say it would have been that high on the list. So I absolutely love those films. And we have Steve in Topsha, Maine, who also had a couple that we forgot.
He writes in, longtime listener, first time emailer, I enjoyed your top five on the run flicks this week. However, I do feel that there were a few glaring omissions. In no particular order, The Fast Runner from Australia, No Country for Old Men, Minority Report, and The Warriors. Adam, I cannot believe I forgot The Warriors.
I can't believe I forgot it either. It would have at least been an honorable mention.
I am knocking off Pierre LeFou. Warriors is my new number five.
Walter Hill, I believe, directed The Warriors,
love
who also wrote
movie.
The Getaway, so it would have been a perfect tie-in
love
last
that
week. You had Minority Report in the honorable mention, but how did we overlook No Country for Old Men? I know we need to put a moratorium on discussing that film on the show, but that said, on the run movies, that whole movie is about Josh Brolin trying to get away with this money, and it's one of my favorite films of the past 10 years. Again, another one I somehow completely forgot. I have no good excuse. It also would have been in the top five. And we also had a listener, Dusty Caruso, who had The Warriors as his number one. I like his comment. I was shocked that neither of you mentioned this film. Yes, I admit that it is not in the pantheon of classic films, but it has to be one of the most stylized and iconic cult films of the late 70s. He's right.
I completely agree. I'm kicking Godard off my list to put it at number five.
For The Warriors.
I love The Warriors.
That's the kind of incisive.
I love the baseball furies. It's awesome.
And the clowns. Aren't they wearing like clown suits at some point? I swear to God, there's clown makeup.
It's a metaphor for Reaganomics.
Yeah, I'm sure it's exactly what it is. Before Reagan, somehow? Wasn't this 1979, Maddie?
That's the genius,
of
this film.
It's so prescient,
yes.
The Warriors is. Well, thanks, as always, for the great feedback. Next week, we'll share some of your top five movies about movies thoughts and probably some reactions to this week's top five, our favorite screen teachers. And remember that if everything actually does go as planned this weekend, we expect to have more of your feedback in Film Spotting After Hours. That's a podcast-only edition of the show. We're recording that live at our meetup this Saturday night. Look for that early next week in iTunes or at filmspotting.net.
Time for one last quick break. Adam, those who can't do teach. Those who can't teach, teach Jim. And those who can't make movies, do top five lists on the radio. Our top five screen teachers are up next. Stay with us.
Hair blowing in the hot wind, time hanging from a clothespin. There's no sorrow that the sun's not gonna hail. Smell the leather of your new car, drive through the desert after nightfall. Sleep on the shoulder, keep the stars all to ourselves.
Maddie, it's time now to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday, and an interesting array of stuff that we've talked about here on the show over the past few months. Red Belt, the David Mamet film, is out. It includes an audio commentary with Mamet and the former Ultimate Fighting Champion, five-time Ultimate Fighting Champion, Randy Couture, who is in the film. So if you like listening to David Mamet talk about his work, as I do, and who doesn't, you can see Red Belt now. Great performance by Chiwetel Ejiofor, one of my top five of the year, I believe.
Great performance by Ray Boom Boom Mancini.
Yeah, in his one little bit, he is pretty good in the film. Also, The Recruiter is out now, though it was known as An American Soldier when we saw it back at Sundance.
We really like
a good
this
documentary
film.
It really is worth seeking out if you can find it. It is about a recruiter, an army recruiter down in New Orleans, down in the Louisiana area, I'm sorry, small town Louisiana, who manages to recruit pretty well despite the fact that the Iraq War is going on, but is also dealing with some tough times. It's a really an interesting look at that. Also, Chicago 10 is out, a movie that we did both like, though maybe not love, from the director Brett Morgan. And Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden? Another documentary, though this one a big disappointment from Morgan Spurlock. And then August, you didn't catch it at Sundance, Maddie, but I did. It actually stars Josh Hartnett. This movie just came and went in theaters if it played anywhere. It's not a terrible film by any means. He plays this guy who's the head of an internet company back in August 2001, and really everything is crashing down. You do get an appearance by David Bowie, though, in the film August. If you're a big Bowie fan, you can check that out now.
All right, time now for donations. We want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you to Nat in Dallas, Texas. He is a Gold Club donor. Blair from Whippany, New Jersey. Pruthvi from Pune, India. I believe I'm pronouncing that right.
Nicely done.
Leonie from Preston, Victoria, Australia. I really think we could run for prime minister down there. Jason from Punta Gorda, Florida. David from New York, New York. And Apollo Memories, I'm assuming that's a company.
I'm assuming as well.
In Northwich, Cheshire, United Kingdom. Thank you, thank you, thank you guys so much. And now do remember that for every $10 you donate, your name gets entered into the Film Spotting hat, and at the end of the month, we pick a name, and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. And actually, Adam, this is the last week I think they can get it in for this cycle. We're going to draw a name next week.
Yes, we are. We are going to have an edition of After Hours coming up first. We're going to record it actually this coming weekend, Maddie. But on our next Film Spotting show at the end of August, you will get your name picked out of that hat potentially. So if you want to get your donation in, you have until roughly August 29th, that show on Friday, to get it in.
Plus, you know, you might win a T-shirt, too.
You might.
We're magnanimous here.
We are. We will maybe give out some Film Spotting swag as well. Again, if you want to donate, you can just go to filmspotting.net. You click on that donation tab at the top of the page. And just to mention real quick, again, our next After Hours review, we're talking about the listener's choice movie, Brief Encounter, from director David Lean. I am really looking forward to that. We also want to announce our new contest going on now for another week at filmgaming.spout.com. PBS does Star Wars. This ties in with the Clone Wars, which is absolutely just getting shellacked by critics. They are hating this film, and we haven't checked it out, and I doubt we will, unfortunately. But it did give the guys at Spout a good idea to tie in with that. Tell us your idea for a PBS show or any educational show that ties in somehow with the Star Wars universe. Really breaks that down. The show the Spout guys want to see the most will be our winner. The first prize winner is going to get the graphic novel adaptation of the Fritz Lang film M by John J. Muth and some Film Spotting swag. A second place winner is going to get a $10 Spout gift certificate and a T-shirt. Maddie, tell them where they can enter one more time.
You can find them all at filmgaming.spout.com. And I do have to say, Adam, that I was over there this past week. You know, the internet really scares me.
I know.
I got the address, I wrote it down, and I went over there, and I looked at these entries, and they're funny. There's some really funny ones. And I like this one in particular. It was about PBS in the Empire. So basically, there is a PBS, you know, in the Empire-controlled TV lineup. And, of course, they're doing this frontline expose on this wasteful spending by the Empire. I really sort of like the idea of Bill Moyers getting under the Emperor's skin.
Absolutely. You can check out all those entries and get in yourself on the fun again at filmgaming.spout.com.
I know the trouble's been your good friend. Kept you company on the weekends. Kept you company even once you're...
If you wanted the sky, I would write across the sky in letters that would soar 1,000 feet high to share with love.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. We're going to count down here in a minute our top five screen teachers, tying in with our discussion of Hamlet 2. And, of course, this will be the to sir with love memorial list. But first, a quick note. We want to mention one last time the Film Spotting Chicago meetup going on this weekend. Of course, if you're listening outside the Chicago area or maybe even on our wonderful affiliate down in Virginia Beach on Speakeasy Radio, you are going to miss out on this, unfortunately. But for our listeners in the area, even if you're listening here on Saturday and you're thinking, hey, I did an RSVP, maybe I can't make it out. As long as it's not 8 p.m., you can show up at the Alive One Bar and make it out to the fun Film Spotting meetup. We're going to hang out with about 50 or 60 listeners. We got some guests coming. We got live music performance, and we got a live taping of Film Spotting After Hours. So for more details and to RSVP, you can do that at filmspotting.net/meetup. It is time now for our top five screen teachers. And Maddie, did you have any criterion here? How did you form your list?
Yes, I would actually like to dedicate this list to a one Sharon Robinson.
Okay.
My mother has given 35 years of her life to teaching English to Minnesota's criminally insane and sex offenders.
Wow.
And so I want to dedicate this to her. She's the best teacher I've ever met. She's tough, but she's very, very good.
You're just saying this all because she actually listens, aren't you?
She doesn't listen to
the
show.
Oh, she doesn't?
Oh, no.
Oh.
Not
Wait,
at
you've
all.
Been lying to our listeners all this time? You make stuff up on these shows?
No way.
No.
So my rules here, you had to be a member of the teaching profession. No,
yes.
Mentors,
no mentors
or wizards like Mr. Miyagi or Yoda. And I also said no college professors. I want to save that list for my dad so I can dedicate it to Tim the road. But my number five, and I think you're probably going to laugh at this one, but I, you know, the more I thought about it, I thought, yeah, he does actually kind of belong here. And that's Ryan Gosling in Half Nelson. And the only reason is, yes, he's a heroin user, but
I think he's a crack addict, Maddie.
Whatever. He's doing something in the John.
Yes.
But I love it because he has the audacity to teach the dialectics.
Yes.
To teenagers. This is something that was beyond me in college. And so, of course, we're all failed. He has his own failings. But he really, truly does believe in what he's teaching and getting through to those kids.
Definitely, he plays Dan Dunn in the film Half Nelson. A good pick there. I'm with you, Maddie. I had no mentors. You can't have Obi-Wan Kenobi or Yoda on this list. And I also left off college professors. And I do want to throw out briefly that the worst screen teacher ever is Danny DeVito's character in Renaissance Man. That may be the worst movie about teachers
Isn't
ever.
Isn't that the only movie that you have ever walked out on?
Nice memory, Maddie. Good catch. That and Weekend at Bernie's 2.
You walked out on Weekend at Bernie's 2?
2. Hey, I love the first one. Don't get me wrong. It's gold. But Weekend at Bernie's 2, I'm sorry, just wasn't up to par there with the original. For my number 5, this is one that may surprise you and many of our listeners, but I don't care. It's a little gem from 1987, directed by Carl Reiner, which I completely forgot until I looked it up today, but he directed one Mark Harmon as Mr. Shoop in Summer School.
Mark Harmon, yes. The former starting quarterback for your UCLA Bruins.
That is right, an underrated actor. He's really good in this movie. It's a funny film, and it's really appropriate, actually, because it's the inspirational teacher movie that doesn't take itself too seriously. Mm-hmm. He actually does impact these students' lives for the better, even though the movie is a total over-the-top comedy. And I just have to admit, I spent many a summer day back in junior high watching the exploits of Mr. Shoop and Chainsaw and Dave. I like Summer School a lot, so it's my number 5.
Well, that's a great pick. Well, I'm going to go a little bit more classic on you. I'm going to go back to 1955 with Glenn Ford as Richard Dottier in The Blackboard Jungle. This, of course, the teacher in the inner city who absolutely will not quit, even after other teachers are attacked and his own wife is harassed, based, of course, on the shocking novel 12 years later, Sidney Poitier, who stars in The Blackboard Jungle as one of his students, would then, of course, go on to do To Sir with Love.
Had to be on this list somewhere. Nice job, Maddie. My number 4, another comedy. I have been touched by your kids, and I'm pretty sure that I've touched them. That's Jack Black as Dewey Finn in School of Rock. I mean, come on, he's supposed to be teaching math or whatever, and he ends up teaching all these kids how to rock. From my guy Richard Linklater. I think it's a funny movie. He's my number 4.
It's okay.
It is okay.
It's okay.
It's better than okay.
Really?
It's funny.
You think he's a great teacher?
No.
At the heart of it, do you think he's a great teacher?
It's not about being great. It's about being interesting and memorable.
All right. Fine. Well, if you want interesting and memorable, I will give you Richard Donat as, of course, Mr. Chips from Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Adam, if you want to see me weep like a little boy, there are two movies you could play. One would be Turner and Hooch. The other, Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Unabashedly sentimental, of course, tells the story of Mr. Chipping, the longtime teacher at an English boarding school. Donat actually beat out Clark Gable for best actor in 1939. Clark Gable playing a little character known as Horette Butler.
From what film is that again? I've never seen it.
Yeah, Il Postino.
Il Postino? Nice. Did he win posthumously, nominated for that? Well, my number three, Maddie, you already said it. Let's go ahead and play a clip.
Where are you going?
Home.
I'll give you a ride home.
It's cool. I got a ride.
I don't really think you should be riding with him, do you think?
Drake, is everything cool?
Everything's okay. I'm gonna take her home.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that right, D? Huh? You getting a ride with Teach?
Nah, man.
Drake, come on. Come here.
It's really hilarious, actually, that Ryan Gosling appeared on both of our lists, because Saturday we were sitting there at a play together, along with my wife and your roommate, Duke, and we told him that there was no way Dan Dunn, Ryan Gosling's character in Half Nelson, was going to make either of our lists, and here he is. He's number three on mine. Yes, he's on crack, but he is definitely committed to these students. Yeah. He's trying to engage them, and even if most of that dialectic stuff seems pretty unformed, at least he's trying rather than just going through the motions of these kids. And I do really love Gosling's performance. I think he's fantastic, and it's the last time, unfortunately, I really dug him in a role. He's a really busy actor, too busy for me, but maybe that suits someone who has a drug problem. So he's fantastic there in my number three.
It's a great performance, but it cannot top my number two. That, of course, would be Maggie Smith in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. She stars as Jean Brodie, the free-spirited teacher who teaches her quote-unquote Brodie set about love and art and is not above having affairs with fellow teachers. Maggie Smith in this film is incredible.
Well, Maddie is hitting all of the classics here, the greatest hits of movie teachers, and that's great because I'm sticking with more of the modern stuff, especially comedies, and I'm just going to repeat what Kevin Crossman, our listener, sent in. Shows the struggles of the modern teacher, yet refuses to give up on his problem student. That, of course, Ray Walston as Mr. Hand.
The great Ray Walston.
In Fast Times at Ridgemont High, his problem student won Mr. Spicoli, Sean Penn. He had to make this list for me.
All right, great choice. Well, my number one, I guess it's obvious. Yeah, it's a feel-good movie, but I'm going with Mr. Jaime Escalante in Lean
Calculus.
On Me. Exactly. Look, I know, you cannot learn calculus in only a year after never having been exposed to any math previously. But take that storyline with a grain of salt. This story actually is true. There actually is a Jaime Escalante, and he did get these kids in Garfield High passing the AP calculus exam. He got, I think it was 14 of them in this film, but throughout his career, it's upwards of hundreds. And I think it's absolutely phenomenal. He's a real guy. He was born in Bolivia. And actually, I think he's retired back to Bolivia now.
Really? Well, it is a good movie, one I remember seeing quite a few times. And it's funny because you went the inspirational teacher route for your number one. I did as well. I'm actually going to take some grief for it. I know I'm going to take a lot of grief for it. Let's go ahead and hear a clip.
We're going to talk about Shakespeare as someone who writes something very interesting. Now, many of you have seen Shakespeare done very much like this. Oh, Titus, bring your friend hither. But if any of you have seen Mr. Marlon Brando, no, but Shakespeare can be different. France, Romans, countrymen, Lemurius. You can also imagine maybe John Wayne is Macbeth going, well, is this a dagger I see before me?
Obviously, I chose not to listen to some of our listeners, such as Stephen Wilson in Glasgow, Scotland, who wrote in and said he'd be eternally grateful if we could avoid the dreaded Dangerous Minds / Dead Poets Society picks. Also, Daniel Davis in Columbus, Ohio wrote saying, please, please, please spare us a rundown of inspirational teachers who create a bond with an entire class, whether of the urban Edward James Olmos in Stand and Deliver or prep school Robin Williams in the so very overrated Dead Poets Society variety. Well, all I can say to Stephen and Daniel and everyone else is, I'm sorry. Maybe Dead Poets Society isn't cool. It's not fashionable anymore to say you like it. It is probably all a little overwrought. In fact, I know it's all a little overwrought when you see it now. But when I was 14, the movie, and especially the teacher, John Keating, who Robin Williams plays, it inspired the hell out of me. And I think Williams is genuinely good in it. There was actually a time, Maddie, and I will admit this, there was a time back in the late 80s, early 90s, when I considered, if you asked me, Adam, who's your favorite actor? And again, I was pretty young at this point. I was in high school. But if you'd asked me who my favorite actor was, Robin Williams would have been in the conversation of the top two
or
three. Me
too. He would have been my number one.
Yeah,
there's
no
reason to be ashamed of that. What he was doing on Broadway and in film was phenomenal. You had, you know, Good Morning Vietnam coupled with this film.
The Fisher King, he's very good in that. You have my all-time favorite movie, maybe. I mean, one of those movies I absolutely adore that no one else likes, but The World According to Garp, he was in that, one of his first films, if not his first. And then you had this movie, Dead Poets Society, again. I know it's easy to rip on now. I didn't plan on going with inspirational teacher movies here for most of these picks, but he ended up being my number one. I really loved that movie when I was younger kid.
Yeah, and I will admit, it does get a little dusty in the theater at the end there when Ethan Hawke does stand up on that desk. Oh, man.
Do you have any honorable mentions, Maddie?
I don't, actually. I don't. You covered most of
them. Okay, well, for me, I do want to mention Steve Coogan in Hamlet 2. I think he's up there. Olivia Williams in Rushmore. And a little seen movie here, but a good one, Jeremy Irons as a teacher in Waterland, another movie with Ethan Hawke, but Waterland's a good movie, so check that one out if you haven't seen it.
Olivia Williams in Rushmore, yeah. Do we ever actually see her teach?
No, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I like the fact that she has this relationship with the main character, Max, and, you know, kind of tells him off at different points. There's something, there's a new angle there we haven't seen on the teacher before, Maddie.
I think you're coming at that purely from a Max Fisher angle.
Maybe so.
All right, well, those are our top five screen teachers. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, it is quite a spate of films, Matt, here to choose from.
Wow.
You have Death Race with Jason Statham, who is almost cool enough to make me want to see Death Race. The House Bunny with Anna Faris.
I cannot wait to see this film.
I know, which I actually want to see. I saw a movie with my wife a few weekends ago. This was the trailer before it, and she sat there just looking at me like I was a moron because I was laughing throughout the whole trailer. I'm sorry. Anna Faris makes me laugh. It looks like it could be funny. Also, The Long Shots, the inspirational movie from Ice Cube, and The Rocker, which seems to be getting some good reviews, of course, stars Rainn Wilson. I'm going to have to check that one out as well. In limited release, Hamlet 2 with Steve Coogan, which we do recommend, and IOUSA. This is a documentary from, I believe, the guy who did Wordplay, the documentary about people who do crossword puzzles, which I like quite a bit. IOUSA, I saw at Sundance, actually. Not as effective, but it does sort of lay out for idiots like me who don't understand the national debt and that stuff at all. It's kind of dry, but really actually makes it pretty accessible. So,
is it a Warren Buffett joint?
He is in it. I don't know how much of a role he plays in it behind the scenes, but he does have a small role in the film during some interviews. Also, Elegy, that film with Penelope Cruz and Ben Kingsley, is expanding to about 100 screens. On next week's show, we'll review Woody Allen's Vicky Cristina Barcelona, speaking of Penelope Cruz, and we're going to hand out our Heist Marathon Awards and preview the Toronto Film Festival with our top five Canadian films. And I don't know if we've actually decided yet, Maddie. Does this mean movies that were made by Canadian directors, or do they have to be shot there in Canada?
I don't know. Maybe we should leave it up to the audience.
Maybe we should send in your suggestions and ideas for that. Feedback@filmspotting.net.
Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable assistance, and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. A special thanks to Tori Malatia and Steve Edwards at Chicago Public Radio, along with Golden Joe Dassault for his great, great production help. And to Connor Oberst and Merge Records for this week's music. Learn more at mergerecords.com. For Film Spotting, I am Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
You know, it's amazing that you two can be absolutely correct about every point you made in your review of Pineapple Express and still be wrong. Your feedback is next. Stay with us.
Comic book guy wrote in?
No, that'd be more... You know, it's amazing that you two can be absolutely correct.
I think I can do it.
I think I can. Yeah. You know you can. Go get him, Adam. Go get him. Bring the film spotting.
Are you done?
Bring the film spotting. I want the truth.
Uh-huh.
Can you serve the truth? Can you serve me the truth, Adam? Don't be worried about
what they think. Jesus Christ Superstar or something?
You gotta tell them no matter what. Who cares what the boards have to say? We're gonna love you anyway. Film spotting. Go, film spotting.
Seriously. Are you done?